Before getting started, I just wanted to highlight your results from the last tutorial, which was about classifying spirals that was shown in as is shown in this figure over here. So in that case, we have three spirals, and you're asked to, in that particular case, use a feedforward neural network to classify these spirals. So one question you were asked to do is to investigate the training accuracy as a function of the number of hidden neurons. So as was expected, as you increase the number of hidden neurons, the accuracy is expected to increase. So that's a good thing. And so this is one of the group's results. So if you have four hidden neurons, so that's Q equal four, you see that the decision boundaries are not as good. You don't see that the feedforward neural network is classifying the spirals very well. But as you increase Q, you see a better decision boundary in particular over here, where the classification is doing better. But one thing I wanted to highlight is in the limit when you have a very, very large number of hidden neurons. So this was another result in your group, where if you're, for instance, if you're using 500 neurons, so and if you're going from 100 to 500, you see there's a tendency to that the accuracy is going down. So this could happen in, for instance, in other applications. So if you see this happen, this means that you either need to change the learning rate or change the optimizer or change the activation function. So always when you see that something like this happening, it's a good sign that you need to change something in terms of the hyperparameters. It could be intrinsic to the architecture, so that might be always the case, whatever you change, but at least whatever you see this. And if you didn't if you have only investigated one set of hyperparameters, then it's a good sign to change the hyperparameters to eventually get a larger accuracy. Okay, so that was in terms of the scaling with the number of neurons. Another question was asking about the accuracy scale with respect to the amount of noise. So one thing you would expect is that the accuracy would decrease with an amount of noise, and that was exactly what was highlighted in this plot. So here on the right axis, you're seeing the training accuracy, and on the left axis, you're seeing the train cost, and they have the opposite trends, okay? So the training cost is increasing with the magnitude of the noise, and the training accuracy is decreasing with the same parameter. And you can see, for instance, for this smaller magnitude of the noise, you can see good decision boundaries. And here you see a lot of noise in this plot, particularly where it's harder for the architecture to make a difference. So it makes sense why it's harder. And finally, one thing I also wanted to show you is the accuracy with respect to the number of branches, or K, where you also expect that it's going down. So you see here that it's going down as a function of the number of branches, and if you compare that to the random search, which is 1/k, that's still better than 1/k. So for instance, 1/10 is 0.1, and here the accuracy is close to 0.35. So it's still better than doing something that's random. Okay, so that's still good. And one final thing before we get started in the lecture is this observation that early stopping allows to overcome some sort of overfitting. Of course, here we didn't define testing data set to precisely define overfitting, but you could see that because that we have these weird decision boundaries, you would expect that if we have some data set that belongs to the green data points over here, that would be misclassified. So early stopping helps actually to cure this. So I just wanted to highlight that in the example of this tutorial. Okay, so this is all I wanted to show you for the beginning of today's lecture. And the main topic of this lecture will be about convolutional neural networks, which is another type of neural network architectures. And there is a reason why they are defined. And this is what's going to be the main topic of the beginning of this lecture. So in the previous lectures, we have learned about the feedforward neural network, which is a bunch of layers made of a bunch of neurons that are fully connected to each other. So we have each neurons in the L layer, is connected to the neurons, fully connected to the neurons in the L plus one layer. And you could see that this, like this full, having neurons that are fully connected to each other is not good when you have key properties like locality and also translation invariance. So for instance, if we have a picture where we're focusing only on a small region, like it's not a good idea to also include other information from other features like very far away. The same thing if you have translation invariance, if you translate a picture of a cat in a picture, you still need to classify that picture as a cat and not as something else. So these are key informations that needs to be like preserved during the learning process. And it turns out that convolutional neural networks are very good at doing this. So today we're going to learn about key topics or key concepts in convolutional neural networks. So those are examples of those topics that we will hopefully learn today. And just to, again, reinforce this intuition that we need to think about another architecture, we could take this simple example of a small picture, like let's say 4x4, where I'm going to label each pixel by number. So I'm going to go from 1 to 16. So now, if you want to feed that picture to the feed-forward neural network, as we've seen before, one way is to flatten that picture into one-dimensional vector, right? So one thing we could do is the following. So we could feed that all of that so we will have that first row in the first part of that vector, and then we will have, again, the next element will be 5, and then we'll complete that using the similar logic until we get the last element of that vector, okay? Mm-hmm. So now, one thing, so maybe I could ask you that question, like, so what do you see problematic about doing this transformation? Yeah.
Taking into account the locality that you mentioned, for example, we would expect that 16 should, like the formation of 16 should depend on the formation of 12 and not just 15.
Exactly, yeah, that's a very good point. So locality, you could also see that from 4 and 5, right? So 4 and 5 are actually like very far from each other, but here they're close. So that's one thing too. So those are not spatially close. So that's also, so that's an issue. Although here 3 and 4 are spatially close, but that's not the whole story, because we also need other, you take into account also the other neighbors in with respect to the other pixels. So that's one problematic thing about this mapping, where we flatten the picture into a vector. So in that case, locality is lost. Another key motivation for a convolutional neural network is with respect to scalability of the architecture. So imagine that we're given some sort of a picture that has size 2,000 by 2,000, right? Oh, sorry, 200 by 200. And let's imagine that we have 3 channels for this picture. Are you familiar with RGB channels when each picture has 3 channels? So that would be, so the size of this picture will be 200 by 200 by 3. And if we do the flattening of this, then we'll get a big vector that has exactly that size. And let's imagine that we want to feed that into like a hidden layer that has 1,000 hidden neurons. Okay, so we know that like going from the input layer to this hidden layer involves like a weight matrix and a bias, right? So do you have an idea about what will be the size of this weight matrix? Can you guess? What would be the size of that weight matrix given this input size in this size of the hidden layer?
The multiple
Sorry, can you say that again?
multiple between these two matrices.
Exactly, so we multiply that by that. So that will be 200 by 200 by 3 by 1,000. And that's a very large number. So in fact, that's actually 120, 120 million parameters. So you could clearly see that if you have even larger pictures, you will have to deal with very, very large number of parameters. And that's a clear sign that we need to use another architecture. And actually, the convolutional neural network will solve like these two problems, in addition to the fact that we will also have that translation variance solved. And that's going to be clearer as I'm going to explain the convolutional neural network architecture. Okay? So are these two kind of issues very clear for you so far? Okay. So this doesn't say that the feed-forward neural network is not useful. It is useful in some applications. It just turns out that in terms of image processing, and also maybe in other applications where you have a lattice, a two-dimensional lattice of spins with a very large system size, then it turns out that it might not be as efficient as the convolutional neural network, as we're going to see in a few minutes. So the solution is to use convolution. And let me explain what I mean by that. So let's imagine that we are again given that picture. 4 by 4. So what we do is we take what's called a patch. So it's also called like a local receptive field. Like you could find that name as well in the literature. Could find also the name of a kernel or filter. These are all different names for that same like patch over here. So that patch is something that's smaller than the picture itself. So for instance, here it has size 2 by 2. And what you do is each time like you have an overlap with some portion of the picture, you take the dot product of all the elements of that patch with that subpart of the picture, and you compute another image, also called the feature map. So for instance, the first element over here, that corresponds to the dot product of the patch with that portion of the picture. So maybe to explain this more, if that element is D, is D1, and if the patch is A1, let's call that F1, F2, F3, F4, and if the elements of the picture, let's say, are A1, A2, A3, A4, then D1 is equal to what? So based on the definition. So what would be D1 as a function of these A1s and F1 until F4?
Summation AI.
Exactly, yeah. So just a sum from 1 to 4 of A1 times F1. Okay. So I'm going to comment about the general definition later on, but this is just an example for this dot product operation for a sub picture, for like a part of the picture with the patch to get one element of this feature map. You can imagine that you could slide that patch to this part over here. so that you can compute this second element of that picture. And you could imagine doing that again and again until you get your whole, like all the numbers in your feature map, okay? Yeah.
Sorry, I don't understand where the Fs come from.
Yeah, so those are, so F1, F2, F3, F4 are given by this kernel or the patch. So this is something that's given in your, like, so hopefully this will become clearer after I go on to define the architecture, but the this is like basically like a kernel that's used to convolve this picture to get like what's called a feature map.
The data, it's something you design.
No, this is something you design, and it's actually something that's learned during gradient descent. So those are ways you could convolve this a picture into like a new feature map. So maybe what I could do is, maybe to illustrate this a bit more, I could show you a demo, just so that you could see how this convolutional looks like in principle. Okay, in practice. Thank you. Okay, so what you see here is a 4x4 image and also a 3x3 filter that's sliding through the picture. So that's a convolutional operation that allows to obtain this green feature map, which is in that case a 2x2 image. There are also other examples. So here what we're defining is what's called the padding, which I'm going to define in a second, where it's basically enlarging the picture by a bunch of zeros. And here we're seeing that we have a 4x4 patch or kernel that's like sliding through the enlarged picture to obtain like this feature map over here. Okay, yeah.
Does the feature map depend on our choice of kernel?
Exactly, yeah. So this is like the other demo I wanted to show you. So for instance, imagine that you're given this picture, right? And you slide it with this kernel. So this is called it has a name where basically it has a bunch of numbers. So those are the numbers you see over here. Okay, and so those are given in that case, but of course in the training process, those are numbers that you learn during gradient descent. And you can see, for instance, that doing the convolutional operation, this will give, on the right side, this will give you this feature map where you can see that it's easier to identify things like, well, the eyes and also the top of the head. So it basically allows to identify more elementary features that are easier to learn compared to the initial picture. And if I use like different kernels, for instance, that one, you see different things. Like for instance, I can identify the mouth, a bit of the ears. So you could imagine that using different kernels would allow you to identify different features so that you are able to make a better prediction at the end. Okay? So does it make sense why convolutional is very helpful in that case? At least in practice. Okay. So that's good. Now let's move on to generalizations of the convolutional operation. One thing we could do is padding, which as I've highlighted is a way to enlarge the picture with a bunch of zeros. So this is helpful in some cases where you want to introduce you want to tell the convolutional neural network that this is some sort of a boundary. So it's a good idea to enlarge the original picture, which has size L by L to a size L plus 2Z to NZ. And here L plus 2NZ, okay? So this is just a common practice in this field where we typically are you add, like you could either add a bunch of zeros, or you could maybe take periodic boundary conditions into account where you copy this value into this part over here. So that could be also one way you could do the padding. Also, another thing you could tune is the batch size. You could also see in PyTorch other terminologies like kernel size, filter size. So those are all means the same thing. So in that example, that's a 2x2 batch size. But you could choose 3, 4, like the depending on the size of your picture. Of course, like it's always good to start small. The extreme case will be 1x1, but that's not something that would be able to give you spatial some good like information after the convolution. So the minimum you could start with that's helpful is 2x2, and then you could start increasing it and see if that's will give you a better result. So you could start from 2x2 until so the other extreme case is L by L, which is not helpful, but maybe the other extreme case will be L minus 1 by L minus 1, where you have at least some freedom to slide the picture by one element. Okay. Another thing you could tune is the stride. So what this means is that if I'm given again the same picture, 4x4, and again, I'm given the same filter size, 2x2. And imagine that I have a stride S equal to 2. Then what this means is that instead of sliding after doing the dot product operation, what I do is I'm going to slide this filter by a step of 2. So instead of being somewhere here, so that corresponds to stride equal to 1. Instead, it's going to be in this. It's going to be over here in the next operation. And basically, all the operations that I'm going to do will be these four. And that's why the size of the feature map will be that one. Okay. So it will be instead a 2x2 instead of a 3x3 in that case where the stride is equal to 1. Yeah.
One question. So in this earlier example,
yeah,
is there any padding procedure on the earlier this example?
Can you say that again, please? Like, is there any?
I still cannot understand what's the function of padding procedure. Is there padding procedure already in this example?
Oh, the sliding procedure? Like
padding procedure.
Oh, can you say that word again?
Padding.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So over here?
Yes. So why would we have that?
Oh, while we have the padding, is that your question?
I still cannot understand what is padding after.
Yeah, so one motivation behind the padding would be to introduce a bunch of zeros at the boundary. So this could tell like the neural network that this is the boundary and you have to kind of like learn like that. So it's some sort of a way to like tell some information that this is a boundary, like without having to make the. So maybe one thing I could say here is that if you have a batch size and you have a bunch of zeros, you'll have the product with zeros. So that could tell you information that this is like a boundary instead of the bulk where you have non-zero numbers in the middle. So that's one motivation behind padding. Another motivation would be to introduce maybe periodic boundary conditions. So for instance, if you have one value over here and you want to introduce periodic boundary conditions, then you could copy that value to the padding over here.
Okay, then in these two examples,
yeah,
there's no padding.
There's no padding, right. Oh. But in principle, like you could always imagine that you could always start from like this 2x2 image and then enlarge it so that you have a larger image. So so this example also holds when you have a picture with padding. And this padding could be, it doesn't have to be 1, it could be either 2 or 3 or any number you want. Okay? But general practice that you start with one and see if that helps with improving the accuracy. Yeah.
I think another reason could be is that you can collect more information about the picture if you're using like an extra zero layer, because when you're going without extra zero layer and applying kernel, you're collecting a sum of each square by each step. If you add in one more zero, like row and column, you basically can collect more sums.
Exactly, yeah. So that's exactly another motivation. Like if you have, for instance, like a larger image, then you're going to have a larger feature map. And basically the boundary values of that feature map will highlight those like patterns exactly as you mentioned. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Does a stride have to be a factor of the length of the image? Like for example, here, would it make sense to talk about s=3?
So if you have l=3?
S equal 3.
S=3, right? So yeah, in that case, that would not be compatible. So that's another comment I want to highlight that, like in a second regarding the compatibility of different parameters. So that will be a comment that will become clearer as we're gonna compute the size of each feature map as a function of the other parameters. So imagine that the initial picture, you can call it A0. So that's the definition we have used before in the course. So imagine that has size L by L. Now, after doing the convolution operation, we will get some feature image. We can call it A1. That will have size L1 by L1, right? So if you have if you do this convolutional operation, given some padding, given some stride, it turns out that you can show that L1 is equal to L minus the L patch, which is a patch size, plus 2 times the padding size over the stride size plus 1. Okay, so that's the case when you don't take periodic boundary conditions into account. So this is like when you're here and you stop doing the convolution operation. If you're doing the convolution as if you're assuming that you have some sort of a torus, then so using conditions, then the expression of L1 is simply L over the stride size. So you could see, so for instance, that will answer your question regarding the compatibility of different hyperparameters. So if you compute this and you get something that's not an integer, so if you get like 3.5 or something that's not an integer, then this means that the set of hyperparameters that you chose are not compatible. So you need to choose these hyperparameters in such a way that this is an integer. Okay. So maybe just to convince you that this is the right formula in the normal way of doing convolution without taking periodic boundary conditions into account, we could, for instance, take an example of maybe I could do that over here. Let's assume that I have a 7x7 picture. Okay, and let's imagine that I have also 3x3 filter. Okay, so imagine that there is no padding, so nz equals 0. And let's imagine that also the stride is equal to 1. So what do you think would be the size of the feature map in that case? without using that formula, but just by using the convolution.
From before.
So let's see. So we will have the first operation over here. So that will give us that first number here. Now, if we slide it by one, so that will give us this batch. So that will be the second one. We'll slide it again. And then we'll slide it again. So that will give us a four. And there will be a last one, right? Mm-hmm. So it's going to be, yeah, so you're almost. So it'll be five, and also the same thing vertically. So there'll be a 5 by 5. And if you're using the formula, then you could see that L1, if you apply the formula, so that's 7 minus 1, sorry, 7 minus, sorry, that 7 minus 3 plus 0, 2 times 0 over 1 plus 1, which is 5. Okay? So this is just an example. You encourage you to show that formula in the general case if you want. Yeah.
Would it make sense to talk about rectangular filters?
Yeah, absolutely. You could also use that, but that formula will not hold. Like, you'll have to consider L1x along the x direction, L1 along the y direction. So you'll also have rectangular feature maps, but that's always possible for sure. It's just sometimes it's easier to handle like square feature maps, but yeah, it doesn't mean that they're not useful. Okay, so that's the case of the normal convolution, assuming that you have open boundary conditions. But if you have periodic boundary conditions, that's, in that case, we're also allowed to continue. We're not going to stop over here. We can actually continue. So we'll have these extra elements borrowed from here. Right. So you'll have the chance to do another two extra convolutions. So instead of having 5, you'll have 5 plus 2, that will be 7. So it will have a 7 by 7 feature map. And if you apply the formula, that's 7 over 1, which is still 7. So when you have periodic boundary conditions, that's the formula that you have for the size of the feature map. Yeah, I went over this quickly. Let me know if I need to go over it again. Is that clear for you? Yeah. No, I can do an example again if you want. Do you want me to do it again for periodic boundary conditions?
Yeah, maybe with a smaller
matrix. Sure, yeah. So for instance, do you want me to do it from that example, or maybe a smaller?
So I'm just not saying, I said that if we'll do the 5 that we said, it's the end.
Yeah, and at the end, what I could do is copy. So I could copy that column over here, and also copy that one over here. And then I could still continue to slide my kernel. So that's the last kernel that I could do if I have periodic boundary conditions. But if I have periodic boundary conditions, I'm still allowed to continue.
Oh, yes, I forgot that it's a 3 by 3. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so I could have a kernel over here and also a kernel over here. So that will give you two extra convolutions that I could do, and I'll add two other on that 5. So that will be a 7 by 7 feature map. Okay. Okay. So I don't want to miss anyone. If not clear, let me know. I could repeat it again. Okay. So now, so let's see how that applies, for instance, to the example of the Eisen Z2 gauge theory that we've done in the previous lecture. So for the Eisen gauge theory, you remember that we had an expression that looks like that. So let me do it in a motherboard. Okay. So we had a lattice that looks like this, where so we have spins that live on edges. So I'm going to denote the spins that have that live on the vertical edges as triangles, like this. And the other ones, like the, are on the vertical edge as some sort of squares. So I'm going to explain why I'm doing this distinction in a second. Okay. And over here, you could see each node over here as some lattice sites. Okay. So in that picture, in that representation, you could see that we have some sort of two channels, right? So in pictures, we typically have three channels. In that representation, we have two channels, where the first channel corresponds to the sublattice one, which is represented by triangles, and the second channel corresponds to the second sublattice. And basically each lattice site, which has coordinates x and y, will have two elements from each channel. So we will have one triangle from the first channel and one square for the second, from the second channel or for the second sublattice. Okay? So is this clear for everyone? And we can denote the values of each element by three elements. So we will have first x and y, and we will also have the channel index, which we can call c. So x and y will denote the spatial information. And c will denote the channel. So that's the typical name for that we have for real-world applications, for instance, in images. But in that case, for this physical application, we'll have a sublattice index. Okay. So this basically is saying that for each lattice, we'll have a set of two images instead of just one. So we're dividing this whole lattice into two pictures of triangles and a picture of squares. That's another way of seeing this, okay? So far, so good. Okay, and for instance, when we do the convolution, we do it on each channel. So for instance, if we have a picture with RGB channel, we do that for the red channel, the green, and for the blue. But for here, it's going to be for the first channel, when the first sublattice is on, and another convolution on the second subchannel. Okay. So now you might be wondering what's the expression, mathematical expression, that is that's the general case when you have different channels and different spatial dimensions. So what we can do is start from some feature map, or start from the initial picture a different spatial information, a different spatial positions, and also different channels. So this is going to be a bit more complicated, but I'm going to try to explain it step by step, hopefully. But if it's not clear, I'm going to do another demo, so don't be afraid if it's too complicated for now. Okay, so first thing we need to do is to sum information along the channels. So for instance, in real world applications, we need to we need to do this convolution along different channels. So this number is actually a number that we get as a sum of different convolutions coming from different channels. So we need some sort of a sum from C equal to 1 to the number of channels NC. So NC here is equal to 2. But for pictures, that's equal to 3, OK? Now, I need also to consider my patch size. So my patch size could be seen as some weight matrix that will have size L patch by L patch. So I'm going to denote the indices of that patch size, of that filter or patch size by M and N, where these indices go from 1 to L patch size, and N goes from 1 to L patch size. Okay? And I also need to consider different filters for different channels. So I also need to add another index C. Okay? So that's for the definition of the filter. Now, in order to do the convolution, I need to consider the intersection, like the overlap between the patch and a portion of the picture. So that corresponds here in the sum as doing this operation over here. So by doing this and translating the elements of the picture, it turns out that's actually exactly as doing this operation over here. Okay, so this might not be clear, but initially, but if you do an example, then this will become clear. So all I wanted to say here that this is exactly as the same as doing as taking a portion of the picture and doing the dot product operation, similarly to what you see in over here. Okay. Now, another thing we do typically in the convolution operation is that we consider many filters in addition. So we don't only do this for one channel. We can actually for one filter at different channels. We also do this for different filters so that we could learn different features. So you remember that example where we could learn about the ears and the eyes, another channel. Another filter could help us to learn about the mouth and the head. So the idea is that we could combine all these different information so that we have like a better way to do that classification or the task we're interested in. So that's why we need to add another index. So that's the index of the filter. And again, similarly to feedforward neural networks, we also have another bias that depends on the filter index, and similarly to what we have seen, similarly to what we have seen for feedforward neural networks, we have a nonlinear activation function. So I'm going to move these sums this way. Okay. So again, I don't want to scare you off with this formula. So hopefully it will become clearer as I'm going to show you the demo after.
Could you repeat what the K index is?
Yeah, so the K index is, yeah. So maybe I could write that down. So K index corresponds to the label for different filters or patches.
Is this determined by any of the grids or is this arbitrary?
So this is a hyperparameter that we choose. So for each convolution operation, we define how many feature maps we want to have at the end. So that K, the number of these filters that we can call NF, determines how many feature maps at the end you will get after the convolution.
Okay. Is this independent from the grid size slash the patch?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So if you want to get like two feature maps, that NF will be 2. Okay. So K will go from 1 to 2. If you want a 10, that will go from 1 to 10. Okay. So that's a hyperparameter. And you expect that the larger this NF is, the more feature maps you'll have and more elementary features that you'll get in each picture. Yeah. So now C is that channel or sublattice index. And M, basically that's the parameter that, so the index of the X index of the patch or the filter. And N is the Y index of the filter. So here I haven't like specified anything about the layers, but it turns out that you could do these operations on many layers. So here what I'm going to take is the information coming from the L minus one layer. So that means, for instance, for L equal to one, that will be the input image. And so that's why here I also need to include dependence on the layer index. So I will have different filters at different layer and different biases at different layers. And at the end, I'm gonna get my feature maps. So those are equivalently the activations that we had in the feedforward neural network, but in a different format. So they're gonna be pictures called feature maps. And as you might have guessed, so the C index is something that we sum over. So we're not going to have dependence over here. The indices that are left are the K and X and the Y, okay? So here we will have X, Y, and K and dependence along the layer index, okay? Okay, so far, so good. So again, just to clarify, this is an activation function. And maybe one last thing I could highlight here in this equation is that the filters actually correspond to weight matrices, which are learnable parameters during the gradient descent operation. So the numbers that we have, for instance, in F1, F2, F3, F4 are not given. So those are something that you initialize randomly when you train convolutional neural networks. And those are parameters that are trained during using gradient descent until you get something that would allow you to get feature maps that could allow you to detect maybe features in your picture. Okay? And maybe another comment I want to highlight is that you, as you see over here, those the indices do not depend on the indices of the image, right? So this highlights that the fact that we have translation invariance, because we in the feedforward neural network over there, the parameters depend, so it depend on the lattice, on the input image index, but here there's no dependence on X and Y. So this highlights that we have translation invariance embedded in the architecture. So no dependence on X and Y. Okay, so that is translation invariance. Okay, so one last thing before showing you the demo online, so that it becomes clearer, so that it's become clearer why we have this equation over there. I wanted to show you what's called the pooling layer, which is one last ingredient before defining this convolutional neural network. So typically, when we have some sort of an image or a feature map, we want to make it smaller so that we can make the training faster. So one thing we could do is define a smaller image by downgrading the pixels. So this is called a pooling operation, which will result in a smaller image, where this square could be either defined as the maximum of the pixels in each bigger square. So that will be the maximum of A1, A2, A3, A4, where those are the A1, A2, A3, A4. We could take the average, so that could be also the average. So that's called the average pooling. That's called the maximum pooling. And maybe another case could be the majority rule. If, for instance, we have discrete variables, so if we have more ones than zeros, that the majority will, that pixel will be equal to one. So that's also another possibility. So that's something that helps to make the training faster by making the feature images or the feature maps or the images smaller, so that you can process them faster during the training. So basically, to sum up, the convolutional neural network is a bunch of these convolutional layers dictated by these equations. And at the end, what we will get is a bunch of feature maps that will be fed into what's called a fully connected layer. And that will provide us at the end with some outputs. So this will become clear in the demo here. But there's a question. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm curious, adding the pooling layer, can we do backpropagation? How can we do backpropagation? Because most of the functions are not differentiable.
No, that's a very good question. There is actually a way in PyTorch, like in most like machine learning libraries, to define backpropagation through these like functions. So, for instance, the average, it seems that it's possible for a max. Like I can maybe talk to you after like about how this can be defined for sure. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah.
Mohamed?
Yeah.
Two questions. One, for the majority pooling that you talked about, what happens if we have an equal number of, for example, zeros and ones?
Yeah, so in that case, you could define a type break rule that's always going to be a one if there is an equality. But it's typically, I think those are the those are the most commonly used ones. But I just wanted to highlight that in case you want. Yeah.
I also wanted to ask about the formula you have over there.
Here?
Have you some periodic boundary conditions for the A's?
No, yeah, that's another, it's great that you highlighted this, because this formula doesn't take into account the stride and also the patch size and also the fact that whether we have periodic boundary conditions or not. But you could imagine that if, for instance, that index goes beyond the size, you could use the modulo. For instance, you could use modulo this lattice size so that you can go back to where you started. So this could be a way to implement periodic boundary condition using the modulo. And for for defining like the pattern, I think you'll have to also define like where your indices k and x run from where to where. So this is like something that you could do in the code. Although one simple thing we could do is, instead of feeding x as an input, we could define this enlarged picture as our new input, and that's going to be the input that we are going to use to the convolution neural network. Yeah.
It seems like you're trying to take multi-dimensional data and turn it into one dimension by some sensible approach. But if you end up with multiple feature maps, don't you still have multiple dimensions?
Yeah, so the key thing is that the feature maps will contain more elementary features that are easier to learn and to make predictions from compared to these complicated multidimensional inputs. So if you're given a picture that where you have complicated things going on, it might be easier to make a prediction at the end. But if you make a smaller feature maps where you have sorts of edges that are easier to learn, so that will help you to make a better prediction for sure. Okay. So maybe I hope through this last demo to make you less scared of this formula. Yeah. Yeah.
What exactly is happening in the multiple layers? Are we doing, is it just...
What is the multiple layers?
Yeah, like, are we just taking the image and doing convolution, like...
Yeah, so it's basically taking the image with multiple channels, and we produce different feature maps. And again, we take these different feature maps, and we do the convolution again and again. So it's like doing the convolution many times on. To get each time, we hope to get more elementary features. Okay. So this website is called like CNN Explainer. So I have posted those this reference on the portal if you're interested. So this is like a very good way of explaining convolutional neural networks, and hopefully that will help you to connect with what we have seen today. So here I have a picture with three channels of a coffee cup. So I have the red channel, and I have the green channel, and the blue channel, right? And here I'm defining basically 10 different filters. Okay, so NF in that case is 10. And for each, you could see here that each feature map is defined using this smaller filter that's sliding through the picture. So here we're gathering information from the first channel, the second channel, and the third channel. And that's why you see a sum from C equal to 1 to NF. So that's what it means. And at the end, we add a bias. So we add them together and add a bias, and that will give us the feature map, okay, after doing the convolution. And you could do the same thing for the second feature map, third one. And you could see different features happening, right? Like you could see that each filter allows us to define, like to learn different things. For instance, that feature map allows to identify the edges of the cup. So that's for the definition of the feature map before doing the activation. After the activation, we could use, for instance, a ReLU activation function. So that will define these numbers that we've seen over here. So those are the activation, like those are the feature maps after applying the nonlinear activation function. So that will be the first layer. Now, in the following layers, we could take again the same, we could take again all the feature maps in the previous layer. So again, here, instead of having the number of channels, we're going to have the number of the filters, like number of filters in the previous layer. So we're going to sum over all the convolutions in this previous layer. And we're going to add a bias. And then at the end, we're going to get our feature map before applying the activation. So after that, we can apply the activation and also apply a pooling operation. So in that case, we applied the max pooling operation, okay, which resulted in a smaller image. So you can see here, we have a 60 by 60 by 10. And here, we divided the size by a half. So that's a way to speed up the composition, okay? And again, we could repeat the same thing, do the convolution in another layer, and again in another layer, until we get to the last layer where things get more interesting. So over here, so when we get these much smaller feature maps, for instance, like you have a much smaller picture, so that's a 13 by 13 by 10. So what we do is we flatten everything into one vector. And we do the same thing for all the elementary features. So we do the same for all the previous 10 elementary like feature maps. And we gather them into a very large vector. And then at the end we use a weight matrix to shrink them to a smaller size that corresponds to the number of classes that we have. So for instance, here we have, I guess we have the number of classes here. So I guess that's the 12, right? So we have 12 different classes. And that's why here we apply a softmax so that we get a probability of each class. So you can see here that the prediction for the espresso, which is the correct prediction, has a very high probability, so that's about 88%. Okay? Now, if you get a different picture for a school bus, then the prediction will be different, and you will get different feature maps. Okay? Okay, so that, I hope that clarifies the math behind in convolutional neural networks. I encourage you to check this tool after the lecture. And maybe one last thing I wanted to show you is the architectures that you might see in the literature. So one of the very first applications of convolutional neural networks was in this famous architecture called LearNet, which was used to classify handwritten digits called MNIST. So you could see here that we have different feature maps, subsampling, which is another name for pooling, until at the end where you have some sort of a fully connected or feed-forward neural network that takes into account these elementary features. There's also this other famous architecture called AlexNet, where here we have a different representation of the convolutional layers. So it's a three-dimensional, you have a three-dimensional box, which basically the same representation of these feature maps. And one interesting thing about AlexNet is that this is the architecture that got everyone excited about deep learning in 2012, because AlexNet managed to reduce the error by almost 10% compared to the previous approaches in 2012. And it got even better by more developments afterwards. And one of the interesting applications of CNNs are the classification of different objects on a picture, or different features on a picture. They're also applied on other fields of science, and in particular in medicine, to classify like different pictures of MRI machine scans. They're also used in self-driving cars, and even in physics, for instance, in cosmology, to classify different types of galaxies, and also in the context of many-body physics. So here an example of a convolutional neural network that was used to study a two-dimensional system, quantum system called J1, J2. So this is like another application of these kind of tools. And in the tutorial next week, we will see an application of convolutional neural networks to classify the different phases of that system, topological and non-topological. Okay. And again, I encourage you to look at this demonstration of convolutional neural networks when you have time after the lecture. Okay. And one final comment, that there was a typo in the link for the homework, the first homework. So I updated that link so that you can get the data. And again, if you have any question, like I'll be in a few minutes in the second floor bistro in case you have any questions about today's lecture or previous lectures. Okay? Okay, thanks very much.